Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Oliver Sacks. Sacks is the author of numerous best-selling books, including several collections of case studies on people with neurological disorders. He ties his literary style to the 19th century tradition of clinical anecdotes, which incorporate detailed narrative case histories. Sacks counts among his inspirations the case histories of Russian neuropsychologist A.R. Luria. Sacks' 1973 book, Awakenings, was adapted into an Academy Award-nominated film starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro, and his 2007 book, Musicphilia, Tales of Music and the Brain, was a subject of Musical Minds, an episode of the PBS series Nova. His books have been translated into over 25 languages, and his descriptions of people coping with and adapting to neurological conditions or injuries often illuminate the ways in which the normal brain deals with perception, memory, and individuality. In addition to his books, Sacks is a regular contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books, as well as several medical and scientific publications. In 2015, Sacks published the memoir On the Move, which covers the full trajectory of his life and career. Now, for the 1987-88 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Oliver Sacks speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Good evening, and it's a special pleasure being here. I spent 5 years on the West Coast in the early 60s, and I loved coming to the city, and but I never thought I would come again and end up in a church. I gave one talk in a geology museum, but a church is something else. And maybe I should adopt a religious title and say that my theme is neurology and the soul. And one says, why neurology and why the nervous system? I have colleagues who specialize in the kidney, and I like kidneys, and they are wonderful, but the brain is the organ of perception and language and imagination and thought, and the brain partly determines, it is really the brain which determines what sort of life one will have, and is also, of course, determined by the life that one has. And so one way and another, I'm going to try and talk to you, and I hope we can talk together about neurology and life. One can't talk about the kidneys and life. Though, as I say, I have nothing against kidneys. I think if I talk about neurology and the soul, this may be an unconscious memory of a talk of William James, which was called Reflexes and Theism. I think I'm... at some point, not now, but later, I may show a little film, because I have a strong feeling that images are as important as words, and if I always have a pen in one hand, I tend to have a camera in the other. And this is also one reason why I'm going to be talking a little tomorrow. I don't know whether there's going to be any overlap about a film. One tends to take one's experience for granted, and somehow as a whole. One thinks that the world is given to one, say the visible world is given to one, full of color and depth and meaning and movement, and one sometimes needs a neurological mishap to suddenly bring home the fact that nothing is given to one, and one can take nothing for granted, and everything is constructed in the brain or by the organism. And we live in a world of constructs, starting from rather primitive constructs, perhaps like colour, and going on to the complex narratives and theories by which we live our lives. In the... although I wrote, for short, I'm going to call it the Hat book last, I'm... In a sort of sense, I think the theme... I'm going to deal with some of its themes first, and I will then go back to an earlier book and work, but in a way one which I think may raise more fundamental issues than the Hat book. The case histories in Hat are about special faculties of one sort and another, going from rather straightforward ones like the ability to see or smell to things like memory and imagination, the power to recognize, the power to use language, and specific problems which can knock these out. The title story, this was not entirely a contrived title. This actually happened. I was asked to see this patient who was an elderly musician who had started to have peculiar difficulties recognizing people. He wouldn't recognize his students until they spoke. He'd recognize them immediately by voice. He wouldn't recognize their faces. And he didn't, after a while, recognize his wife's face. He didn't recognize his own face. There were extraordinary descriptions sometimes of when he was shaving, that he might have to stick his tongue out or make a face to establish at least a formal correspondence between the reflection and himself. And he made all sorts of strange errors in consequence of this, and at one point in the examination, when he was going right out, he went to get his hat, and he got his wife's head instead, and sort of started to tug, and she had a rather sort of sweet, forbearing look. I think she was used to it. And I thought, my God, this man has mistaken his wife for a hat. But I never thought that that clinical moment would actually become the title of a story, much less the title of a book, much less, I should add, the title of an opera, which has not yet come to the West Coast. But you have that in store. Now, specifically with this man, he saw everything perfectly clearly. He could draw rather well. He could draw outlines, but he didn't know what he was drawing, and he didn't know what he was seeing. Recognition, and specifically meaning, was removed from the visual world. And his visual world had simply become a series of abstractions, of geometries, with sort of strange, often rather Martian descriptions. There was one point at which I'd seen him on a cold day, and there was a glove, and I asked him what the glove... I asked him what this was, and he asked if he might examine it, which as a start is not the right attitude to a glove. And he examined it sort of really like a botanist examining a specimen, and he finally decided that it was a continuous surface enfolded upon itself with five outpouchings. And I said, well, yes, you know, this is a very good description. It would an admirable topological description, but what is it? But he couldn't say what it was. Any child, any monkey, would sort of get it on the hand and would immediately know what it was. But this concrete recognition was missing. It's not entirely easy to imagine this, I think, because we ourselves have been almost from the moment of birth, we make meaning of the world. We construe the world. We construct the world. We can talk later as to whether there are any parallel experiences. We also have to guess at the world. I confess I did have an experience a while back. It was when at a time I was very interested in twins. And I happened to be in a supermarket, and there, to my delight, I saw some identical twins in a perambulator with great shining heads looking at each other. And I was astonished and wondering, and I went closer. And the head seemed to me to be a bit too large and too shining. I thought the twins might have hydrocephalus. And then I got closer still, and the head seemed to me slightly green. And then I thought perhaps they're anemic, or perhaps they're chlorotic, as the Victorians would say. And then I got still closer, and I saw that, in fact, these were two huge honeydew melons in a shopping cart. And I wondered if I was going the way of Dr. P. We are not given the world. One is not given the fact of twinhood or melonhood. You make a guess, you make a hypothesis, you make a construction.
They're having trouble in the back 5 rows, so I can either have to...
Okay. I can't see you too well up there because of the lights, but if you can't hear me, you wave a flashlight or something. Okay, good. To go to a very simple case, in fact, it's just a postscript to a case in the book, I describe a man who has had a head injury and who has lost his sense of smell. And he had thought this would be absolutely trivial. Who needs smell? In fact, he finds that this undercuts his sense of reality and of the vividness of the world to an extreme degree. He comes to realize that smell is a sort of unconscious accompaniment, an undertone to all one's experience. I describe a case of amnesia. When I see a patient, I don't usually home in immediately on the main symptom. I like to talk about things generally for a little while. I saw one patient who indeed was at a loss to know why he was seeing me and who didn't really feel he was a patient. And I asked him to tell me something about himself, and he gave me a very fine, vivid, affectionate story of his school days and how he'd loved science at school and how he'd become a radio engineer on a submarine, and he describes his shipmates and life in the submarine, how the war had ended, and then he stopped. And I said, "Go on." And he gave me a funny look, as you would give me if you had given me your stories until 1988, and I had said, "Go on." And it was evident with him that his story, that his sense of a life had ended around 1945 or 46, that there were subsequent memories, but these were disjointed and incoherent. They didn't form a sequence. They didn't form a narrative. This man had a thing called Korsakoff syndrome, which is due to some alcoholic damage to the brain. I should perhaps reassure you by saying that one can drink very heavily, for the most part, and not get Korsakoff's. But if you start to have anything like this, you better watch out. This man could not hold anything in his mind for more than about 30 seconds. There was one point at which, when I was startled and incredulous of him apparently being in the past, sort of impulsively, and it may have been a cruelty, but I sort of grabbed a mirror, which he described himself as being 19 or 20 years old, and I held up the mirror to this grey-haired man, this man of 50, and I said, "Is that a 19-year-old facing you?" And he was very shocked and panicked, disoriented, and I made an excuse and ran away, taking the mirror with me. And mercifully, when I came back half a minute later, he had no recollection of the incident, and indeed greeted me as if he had never seen me. But one wondered about the quality of existence in someone like this, and the extent to which a problem with memory can alter one's very sense of self. And one somehow felt that this man had been a self, or was a self, up to the point where his memory stopped. I should say that he was an intelligent, charming, kind-hearted man, and one felt him as a very full human being, although sometimes with an odd sort of blankness. I tell stories in the Hat Book of people with language difficulties or aphasia, with people with specific perceptual difficulties of every sort. But one feels with these people that they are still vivid people, or in some sense, to use an old-fashioned term, that perhaps some particular faculty of mind has been disturbed, but the essential person is still there. And therefore, if my theme is to be neurology and the soul, these are not perhaps quite the best examples, because these are people who have their souls and who have full selves, but who have something missing. Although one is beginning to get into deeper water, as with Jimmy, the lost mariner, who at least has an autobiography until 1945 or 46, and nothing after that. I find a certain tendency, which you mustn't misconstrue, and I mustn't misconstrue, I find myself looking more to this side than to you, and I don't want to ignore you, perhaps I will force myself. No, you. This reminds me of one of the case histories in fact, this may be a way of reminding myself of one of the case histories in Hat. It's a very short one called Eyes Right. It describes a rather common situation in neurology and a rather startling one. The patient I describe here was an elderly woman who'd had a stroke in the right half of her brain. And this caused weakness and paralysis on the other side of the body, an inability to see to the other side, but it also caused something more than this. She'd complained to the nurses that she hadn't been given her dessert or her coffee. And they would say, "But there it is, it's on the left side of the tray." And she'd say, "What?" And they'd repeat it. But it was as if the word "left" conveyed nothing to her. And she couldn't perceive anything to the left. She couldn't imagine anything to the left. She couldn't remember that there had been a left. She had no idea that there was a left. Yet she felt herself to be in a complete world. And on one occasion, when I tried to get through about half of her world being missing, she sort of got angry with me and said, "You're talking nonsense. It would be similar if I spoke of a third half to your world." Very strangely, sometimes if one spoke to her from the left, she would either think your voice came from the right, or she would not respond at all. In the nature of things, if one sound must get into the brain and the nervous system, and one could only interpret this by saying that she could give no meaning to anything on the left. One had an extraordinary sense of being in outer space or out of her space if one stood on the left. If she got hung, she developed sort of intellectual recognition of what she couldn't perceive. And if her coffee was missing, she asked for a rotating chair. And if her coffee was missing, she would rotate her chair, and then the coffee and the dessert would come into view on the right. We'll say it would have been much simpler to turn to the left, but this was inconceivable to her. Sometimes she complained that the portion was too small, but that was because she had eaten the right half of the portion, but not the left. And if she felt hungry or suspicious, and she even made a ritual of this, she would do a revolution, and then she would find the missing half of her food, or one ought to say half of the missing half of her food, and make a second bisection. And by this time, she'd have three quarters of it. And she might do it a third time and get 7/8 or 15/16. She developed a sort of humorous recognition of this, and she compared herself to Zeno's arrow, which never reaches its destination. But one would think that space and the sense of space was automatic and given to one. It is very extraordinary and mind-boggling to have a patient like this whose sense of space is radically different from your own and who can't attribute any meaning to personal space on one side. Similar things can happen with a body. And one of my books, A Leg to Stand On, relates a personal experience of this sort. When I had some nerve injury to a leg, and in effect the leg became paralyzed and senseless, but it also lost its sense of reality for me. So although so it felt rather like an object, which was not me, not flesh, not anything. This was sort of a mortifying experience in a way, because one would like to think that the power of the mind could overcome these corporeal weaknesses, that one should be able to think one's leg back into existence. But you can't do this. To use the technical term, if part of the body image, if part of the internal cerebral construct of the body is missing, you can't overcome this by an act of will. Sometimes now in childbirth, rather delicate anesthetics are given, sort of epidural anesthetics. In the old days, when one had massive spinal anesthetics, I should say, a very central problem in medicine is communicating what the matter is. And patients have two problems or two complaints. One is the actual disease or disorder, whatever it is. The other is saying what it's like and communicating it. When I originally saw patients with migraine, this was the subject of my first book, I found that these patients always had two complaints. One complaint was the migraine. The other complaint was that no one had listened and no one had attended, or they hadn't been able to convey what it was like. I found it very difficult to convey, impossible to convey what it was like to the doctors who looked after me. This gave me a vivid sense of the, to use a phrase of De Quincey, of the pressure on the heart, the incommunicable. I also found it sort of, even though I've written a whole book about this, I still feel I haven't quite conveyed the experience, because in fact it can't be conveyed. Am I still inaudible? Sorry. What did you say? Okay. It can't be conveyed, it can only be experienced. I sort of wanted to suggest that every reader should have a spinal anesthetic. If you have a spinal anesthetic, you don't simply become numb from the waist down, you end here. And though there is a pair of legs, hips and so forth, which you can see, it doesn't seem to be yours. It doesn't seem to be anyone's. It doesn't seem to be real. It's not flesh. It's not you. It's not anything. It's quite a frightening experience, even though you may know that it comes back, that it will come back. Because in the sense, there are many neurological emergencies which can produce sort of metaphysical or philosophical emergencies, and the quality of nothingness is one of them. With these problems with body image, in some sense, these are beginning to enter the realm of self. You do feel as if part of yourself is missing, although it's only your corporeal self. Your social self, your intellectual self is perfectly intact, but there may be part of your physical self which is missing. And if you've had a spinal, you cannot will or imagine the rest of your body back. And indeed, you can't remember it. If one has had a spinal, it seems to one that one has always had half a body, except that half a body also seems complete, as in the woman in Eyes Right felt that her world was complete. They're very strange anachronisms. I am too hot, excuse me. You may all do the same. Is it possible to let in a draft? Let's try and do that. Now, once more, on the whole, the patients I describe in the Hat book and some other patients I've written about, most recently one patient I saw who, following a head injury, lost all sense of colour. So he was suddenly precipitated into a black and white world. He was an artist and he was a painter, and this was sort of horrifying to him. Not only did he lose colour in his perception, but he lost colour in his imagination, in his memory. He found foods became rather disgusting. For example, a tomato looked black. But if he closed his eyes, the mental image of a tomato was still black. It was difficult for him to embrace his wife because her flesh looked rather grey and corpse-like and rat-coloured, as his own did. I confess, at this point, I thought of calling that case history the man who mistook his wife for a rat. But I thought that would be going too far. And one shouldn't do the same sort of thing twice. But in his mind's eye, when he went to embrace her, he could still see this grey flesh embracing grey flesh, corpse embracing corpse. He has subsequently, although he's had no recovery of colour, he has become a very remarkable black and white painter. And in a radical sense, that's to say, at first there was a terrible sense of loss insofar as colour had been a vehicle for meaning and feeling and for reality. But now it is no longer a vehicle for this. He finds, as it were, he is rediscovered, or discovered for the first time, an enormous intensity of reality in a black and white world. This may have, I don't know, some analogies to a great black and white photographer like Ansel Adams. But of course, with Ansel Adams, it is done by choice, whereas with this man, it's dictated by physiological necessity. Now, all these problems, loss of colour at the back of the brain, loss of smell in the front of the brain, loss of memory with two tiny little tubercles in the brain, most of these things deal with the surface of the brain, or the cerebral cortex, which is needed to process or construct sensation and language and all sorts of things. And if one has problems here, a particular sort of construction or process is knocked out, but the person is still intact. One really has to go look at the effects of damage or disease to more primitive parts of the brain, to the subcortex, and to what Pavlov used to sometimes talk about, the blind force of the subcortex. And this blind force of the subcortex, in some ways, is what Freud called the id. If there is trouble at this level, then you have radical problems with will, action, desire, feeling, contact, engagement, and in general with the animation of the person. And these were problems which engaged me in an earlier book, Awakenings. And in a way, I think these are more fundamental, because here, the essential person can be affected and disappear in a sort of way, or be deanimated in a sort of way. I think at this point we should have a little cinematic interlude. I said earlier that there's part of me which always wanted to have a pen in one hand and a camera in the other. When Awakenings was published in 1973, it aroused a good deal of concern and curiosity and compassion and, in a sense, incredulity. And there was an urgent wish to see these patients, or to visualize them. And it's always a very delicate thing to write about living patients. It's even more delicate to photograph them, with these particular patients who, in fact, had had this strange illness. This was an illness which affected millions of people in the time of the First World War and shortly after that. There's a viral sleeping sickness, or encephalitis lethargica. Some of these people recovered or seemed to recover, some of them died, and a great many of them were put away in chronic hospitals and asylums all over the world. And when I went to one such hospital in 1966, I found 80 such patients. Most of them, or many of them, absolutely motionless, though standing and sometimes maintaining strange postures. And they tended to look considerably younger than their years. This was partly because they had no facial expression, and their faces were unlined. And they had been in this strange limbo, a physiological limbo, psychological limbo, and a social limbo for 40 years. I'd never heard of such patients. I didn't know that such a situation existed when I was a medical student or a resident. But there are sort of a good many things which ought to be a matter of public knowledge, medical knowledge, but which aren't. Now, I think at this point, a film was made of Awakenings, and what I have here are some little excerpts from the film, about 5 or 7 minutes worth. I wish I could actually skip over the first excerpt, but I can't. The first excerpt is actually some very old film, which was taken in 1918 by Von Economo, the man who described this, who was a most beautiful medical describer and a poetic describer, but who also felt one had to have a camera. And so these are rather rare images first from the First World War. They're intermitted, I'm afraid. I wish I could remove these with what, to me at least, are unpleasing and embarrassing images of my own earlier self making stupid comments about them. But let's have segment... So there are 5 little segments on this with a break in between. Let's have the first segment.
The first alarmist reports of the war. All over the world, doctors were as baffled as the press. They named it sleepy sickness after its commonest symptom, a trance-like state which often overcame its victims for years. In Switzerland, a bride fell asleep at the altar. In France, not even childbirth could rouse one mother. As the epidemic spread, other symptoms multiplied. Parents were horrified to find their children's personalities changed overnight. Doctors reported schoolgirls becoming troublesome brawlers. One victim wrote, "I feel certain that we have all been given another character and that our own died in our sleep." But the more seriously affected suffered only a short agony. Within a few weeks, patients could scarcely talk or swallow. They became emaciated and soon died. More than 1 million during the early 20s. No cure was ever found, and 50 years later, the disease still holds as many surprises as when it first appeared. Dr. Oliver Sacks.
Vladivostok to Vancouver, the disease swept over the world. Or perhaps that's not a good phrase. It's not as if there was a particular movement in a particular direction, but as if 1,000 bonfires got going in different places. The commonest single form were states of sleepiness and torpor, and sometimes as deeper states of coma. And at that time, it was impossible to arouse the most deeply affected people, and as it were, they died of sleepiness. At the other extreme, one saw people who had the most extreme insomnia, an absolute inability to sleep. And in fact, this demonstrated for the first time that that sleep was a necessity, and that one died if one missed one's sleep for more than 7 to 10 days.
It soon became obvious that sleepy sickness affected posture in a variety of ways. Often they seemed contradictory. Many patients had symptoms like those of Parkinson's disease, tremors and shaking of the limbs. Others were caught or frozen in whatever position they were placed, immobile and statuesque. This condition, described as the rigidity of insanity, had previously only been found in schizophrenics and other deeply disturbed mental patients, and it seemed to support the view that these patients neither conveyed nor felt the feeling of life. They had become as passive as zombies.
Just before we... the next image... So this is from 1918. We're now going to jump ahead 40 years, and you're going to see just a brief image of one of the patients as I saw her in the mid and late 60s. This is a very short thing, and I chiefly want to draw your attention to the look of strange entrancement and the feeling of being elsewhere, of somehow, of being elsewhere, which this patient conveys. So the next thing is just a very short segment. It's only a few seconds long, and if we can show it and then stop after it's been on.
...to her transfixed, blocked, entranced state, and subsequently nothing we could do, giving her L-DOPA or anything else, would budge her.
Just as in the...
I should have turned the sound off with that one. This particular patient is called Rose in the Book of Awakenings, and perhaps I should add that she is Deborah in Pinter's play. She had a very acute attack of encephalitis in 1926, and she went almost immediately into this strange state. When she... We... perhaps I'm jumping ahead a bit, but I don't know the order to do things. In the late 60s, there became available for use a medication which had the potential of awakening these patients. These patients, like patients with Parkinson's disease, but this is much more complex, had depression of a transmitter called dopamine in the brain. And one could give a precursor of this, which is called L-DOPA. I hesitated very much about giving L-DOPA. The other film clips you're going to see are about giving L-DOPA, partly because this was such a strange, complex illness, and partly because these people had been absent and out of the world for so long. And so it was more than a medical decision. It became a moral decision, a social decision, a very complex sort of human decision, because one didn't know whether, if these people came to, whether they would have any place in the world. In particular, with this patient, her strange, remote look gave me an uncanny feeling. I kept being reminded of something which James Joyce had written about his mad daughter, when he wrote, when he wondered whether what would happen. He said, when and if she withdraws from the lightning-lit reverie of her clairvoyance and turns her, what then will happen? And what will happen if she turns her regard, as Joyce wrote, on that battered cabman's face, the world? So I wondered what would happen with Sylvie or Rose or Deborah, whatever you want to call her. What did happen was that she became very animated, but in a very anachronistic way. Her language, her allusions, her slang, her mannerisms were of an obsolete sort. They were reminiscent of the 1920s. She was like a flapper come to life. I wondered if she was disoriented, and I asked her some questions, and she gave me a chilling answer. She was a very quick woman. She said, look, I can give you the date of Pearl Harbor. I can give you the date of Kennedy's assassination. I've registered it all, but none of it seems real. She said, nothing has been real for the last 43 years. She said, I've been a spectator for the last 43 years. This sort of removal from... Now, here was a woman of high intelligence, and her perceptions were intact, and her memory was intact, but something fundamental had gone wrong, which had disrelated her from the world. This is some of the uncanny quality of what can happen sometimes if the deeper parts of the brain are knocked out. Essentially, the whole person can come to a stop or only persist in some sort of odd mechanical way. Sometimes they may not even persist in that way. Later in this, you don't see this, but there is one clip in the film when with a particular patient, you see her stuck while she is doing her hair. This goes on and on, and after a while, everyone turns around to look at the projector to see if the film is stuck. But it's not. But the patient's projector is stuck. And in fact, with this particular patient, on one occasion, there was a flood on the floor where these patients were, and I went up and I found this woman knee-deep in water and standing quite motionless. And I touched her, and she jumped. And said, my God, what happened? And I said, you tell me. And she said she had started to run a bath, and there was about an inch of water in the bath, and then I touched her. In other words, she was still stuck at the perception and the thought of there being an inch of water in the bath, and the fact that the bath had gone right up to the top and overflowed hadn't got through. She was ontologically stuck. She was still in the past. She was stuck in the past. So with patients as stuck as this, one might hesitate about trying to alter their situations. Let me show you now to the next film clip about the effects of L-DOPA on some of these patients.
Sachs decided to use L-DOPA, not so much in the expectation of miraculous success, but as a last resort. The condition of many of the patients, now in their 50s and 60s, was deteriorating rapidly. None more so than Lola, who was unable to swallow solid food and was threatened with starvation. She was first given L-DOPA in May 1969 in the hope of keeping her alive. It did much more than that.
Lola had been transfixed in a state of extreme, really in a state of infinite Parkinsonism and catatonia for decades. And her change, her awakening, occurred in seconds. And she jumped out of the chair and she flew down the passage and she burst into conversation. And it was an incredible scene. And I would doubt my own memory were it not supported by everyone else's memory and, of course, by our accounts and films and so forth, which we took at the time.
And this triumph was repeated time and again during the summer. Esther, emaciated and stiff, was unable even to turn over in bed. She was considered a terminal patient. After just 3 weeks on L-DOPA, she was able to walk unaided and left the hospital for the first time in years. Ed was so rigid that he could barely lift a finger. After 2 weeks, he was an active man. At last, he was able to write. Within 10 days, he produced an autobiography of 50,000 words in which he wrote, "With L-DOPA in my blood, there is nothing in the world I can't do." But the most dramatic awakening came in July with Sylvia. After 35 years in hospital, frozen and inert, she regained the enthusiasm for life which had deserted her 40 years before. But something in her manner was strange. Sachs noted in his diary, "Is it possible that Sylvia has in fact never moved on from the past?"
She was in a marvellous mood for a while, and she was talking away and singing and dancing, but almost everything she said and did had reference to 1926 or before.
I'm not quite sure how I'm doing with time. I think I may skip the next two sequences and perhaps just talk about these. With these patients, the summer of 69 was their time of animation and even of resurrection. And this was at first a very joyful and lyrical and festive thing and a delight for them. They came to. And it was sort of an innocent time, an Eden-like time. All sorts of problems developed later. Some of these problems were, and if I were to show you, but I don't think I am going to, some of these problems had a physiological basis. I've said that a lot of the primitive control mechanisms or arousal mechanisms in the brain had been injured with these people, so that first they were deanimated. In the summer of 69, they were reanimated, but then the animation went on and became too much. And from not moving at all, these people started to move too much and talk too much and to get too excited and gradually to push towards frenzy and to develop all sorts of involuntary and compulsive movements and tics and noises and to become more and more explosive. And this explosiveness also attached itself to their imagination and their thinking, so that they became seized by fantasies and passions of all sorts, and they were on the boil. It was a tormenting sort of situation for them, because it was very difficult to get a happy medium. they were either not turned on enough or turned on too much, and some of them alternated between frenzy and trance. And now the other thing was this, that it's not sufficient to be animated, to come alive. You've got to have a life to live. And some of these people came to in a sort of vacuum, a social vacuum, a communicational vacuum, into a world which had no sense for them and no meaning. In particular with Sylvie, whom you saw there, she said she didn't like our television world. And I don't know how much it was this feeling very uncomfortable in the present and how much it was physiological factors which made her suddenly go back to this strange trance-like state after 10 days of animation. But with other patients, one saw that all sorts of things, that there were other things which could moderate them. The last clip, if I were showing it to you, is a rather simple business with, I think, profound repercussions. It's playing ball with these patients. And however entranced a patient is, one of these patients, even if they look as if they are incapable of motion, and even when they are incapable of initiating motion, they can respond. These patients can't initiate, but they can respond, and they can play ball. And you can engage them in an interaction. You can have a sort of dialogue with the ball. And again, however frenzied they are, they can also be organized by something like playing ball. One also saw that relationships were crucial with these patients. And however great the physiological instability, certain sorts of work and certain sorts of relationship could stabilize them. There's one patient whom I describe in Awakenings who used to be a cobbler. He first did beautifully on L-DOPA, and then he went into this terrible sort of oscillation until we set up a cobbler shop with a last and other things in the hospital. And his face lit up when he saw this, and he became a shoemaker and a cobbler for the hospital. And with this, he recovered a social role and a place in social space. And as he did this, his self-esteem increased. He got a sense of himself as a social individual. And with this, the tremendous physiological instability got much less. Freud's final formulation, as you know, is just in two words, that he feels that a life needs to have work and love. One saw this in the most direct way with these patients, that it wasn't sufficient to turn them on physiologically. It wasn't sufficient to give them L-DOPA. They also had to have work and love. And if there were work and love, they could be stabilized. And if there weren't work and love, they couldn't. Maybe this applies to us all. I think we can... let's turn out the lights now. Although they were like this. Maybe this applies to us all, but perhaps the rest of us have sufficient physiological reserve so it's not too obvious until we commit suicide or something. But with these patients, one could see that they would fall apart physiologically unless there was work and love and a place and a social space to hold them. And therefore, if you want, that medicine is not just a question of physiology, but it's and of making a diagnosis, but it's a question of context, of the whole character of the individual, and also of their place in society and the world. Now, finally, I think I want to say a little bit about something which, in my mind at least, follows on from this. I've said that some of these patients, when they became full and overfull of dopamine, became accelerated and developed sudden compulsive movements, tics, noises, exclamations, impulses, thoughts, feelings. One can see And all this reminded me of what was then thought to be a very rare neurological syndrome described a century ago by the French neurologist Gilles de la Tourette, and sometimes called Tourette syndrome. Tourette syndrome usually presents in childhood, and it can vary from so mild as to be almost invisible to devastatingly severe. In Tourette syndrome, one has all sorts of compulsive and convulsive movements, noises, cursing, strange and sometimes provocative behaviors of every sort. The people with Tourette syndrome either have too much dopamine in the brain or perhaps too sensitive to dopamine in the brain, and they can sometimes be given a drug called haloperidol, which is like L-DOPA in reverse, in which damps down the amount of dopamine in the brain. But this can also have problems, as L-DOPA has problems, because you may damp down not only the Tourette's, but you may damp down the whole person, so that perception and imagination and feeling gets damped down too much. Incidentally, Tourette syndrome was thought to be extremely rare. I first saw a patient with it in 1971. The day after this, I thought I saw three people in the streets of New York with it. And the day after that, another two. And the day after that, another two. And this sort of bewildered me. I wondered if I'd been seeing but not seeing these people all my life, if I'd been seeing them but dismissing them as having something else. I wondered if Tourette syndrome could be, for example, 1,000 times commoner than had been described. I had a fantasy that had in fact become a reality, and that there was then a little Tourette syndrome association in New York, which had developed precisely through recognition on the street, and which was 30 strong. Now, the Tourette Syndrome Association is more than 100,000 strong in this country alone, and it's recognized that this is a relatively common syndrome. I don't know whether it's as common in Portland as it is in New York. I have a feeling that New York may make one Touretic. And certainly if one has any tendency that way, it can make it much worse. One of the things about Tourette's is that although there's obviously a sort of convulsive subcortical physiology at work, which produces sudden explosions of movement, of passion, of feeling, of instinct, of sensory enhancement, of enhanced fantasies, although the blind force of the subcortex, or the id, is on the boil intermittently, the thing also obviously has a great deal to do with social space. Tourette's often need to touch others, other objects, other people. Sometimes they need to violate social space and social customs. They may need to be antinomian, or I suppose being in a church makes me use words like antinomian and sacrilegious. There is obviously no center in the brain to do with blasphemy or with sacrilege. This partly has to do with the notion of shocking other people. And this may be particularly severe in Tourette syndrome if there is a restriction of moral space. Sometimes if a Tourette is told, don't do it, he has to do it. I think I'm going to end with a sort of, again, since we are in a church, with a story which perhaps relates religion and disease. With something like Tourette syndrome, which is not just medical, but it is physiological, but it's not just physiological. It pushes out into the world, so it involves interaction with other people. It pushes into social space. And therefore, to examine it entirely, you can't just be a doctor in a white coat. You have to take off the white coat and you have to go out into social space and see what Tourette's is like in the world. You can't comprehend what it's like for a Tourette unless you see him in the world. A few months ago, I went with a friend of mine who is a professional photographer and himself has Tourette's of some severity to a little community in northern Canada. It's a Mennonite community of 700 people, rather inbred. The great-great-grandfather came there from the Ukraine in the 1870s with his heroic virtues, his Tourette's, and his enormous fecundity. And he had 24 children, which is a bit much, even for Mennonites, where I think the average is only 12 or 15. And anyhow, in this agricultural community, people are tending to marry their third and fourth cousins. Essentially, the community is an extended family, now of whom a fifth have Tourette's. I'd previously been very interested in a situation on Martha's Vineyard, which used to exist, where there had been a hereditary deafness for 250 years, so that in some parts of Martha's Vineyard, one in four people were born deaf. The social response to this in Martha's Vineyard was that everyone learned sign. And since everyone spoke sign on Martha's Vineyard when this was the case, in fact, it was rather difficult even to get descriptions of who were deaf. Someone would be remembered as a good friend, a neighbor, a scholar, and a prankster. And you would say, yes, but was he deaf? Well, come to think of it, he was deaf and dumb, but of course, one didn't think of it because he was just the same as everybody else. It was very fascinating and moving, this Martha's Vineyard situation, because not only was deafness not isolating and not a stigma and not a disability, it wasn't even perceived as a fact. And this is astonishing in one thinks of disease sometimes just as a biological thing, but clearly disease is a social construct, or certainly the notion of stigma or alienation is. I went up to this little village in Canada wondering if it would be a sort of Touretic Martha's Vineyard. And this was indeed partly the case. But there is nothing, as it were, socially disruptive or potentially socially disruptive about deafness, whereas Tourette's tends to provoke and explode in the social world. And I wondered what it would be like having, so to speak, a sacrilegious disease in a profoundly religious community. And I wondered what would happen to the Tourette's if they would be sort of ostracized or exorcised or whatever. But in fact, the reverse had happened. And I think something very moving and beautiful had occurred, which is, I think, the existence of this strange, convulsive, provocative illness had caused a sort of moral expansion and spiritual expansion in the community. And I was very much reminded, actually, of there are many blessings in the Jewish liturgy. There are blessings for wine and for bread and for the first fruit of the vine, and blessings for rainbows and storms. There's also a rather special, rare blessing to be said on seeing giants or dwarves or other strange things. And this is and in this one blesses God for creating the strange and for the diversity of creation and for the wonder of the strange. And I think this was the final feeling in this community, that this strange thing was not seen as alien, it wasn't dismissed, and it wasn't punished, but it was somehow I sort of want to say honoured, or at least accommodated, or embraced. And one had a feeling of immense civility and of a great enlargement of moral and spiritual space. And with this, life was okay for those who had Tourette's there. And indeed, my friend himself with Tourette's, who had always been rather stigmatized and isolated and never felt at home, felt so at home in this place that he wanted to meet and marry a nice Mennonite girl with Tourette's and live happily ever after. But I think I've sort of rambled, but I think my final point is that all this about disease and the nervous system has finally got to be embedded in the notion of, among all of you, and in the notion of community. And I want to write a book about Tourette's. I also want to write a book about the deaf. And both of these are taking me out of the clinic and out of the physiology laboratory into the world to see what it's like for them. And I think that this sort of hospitality and civility and spaciousness, which one saw in Martha's Vineyard to the deaf, or up in Alberta to the Tourette's, is something which society as a whole has to show to those who are ill, and particularly who have strange neurological illnesses. And although this doesn't cure the neurological illnesses, it makes all the difference between being intolerably afflicted and finding life quite bearable. And so, as it were, the final remedy lies in you and in the people. Okay, thank you very much. I overshot my time. I meant to stop half an hour ago, but let's take an extra time. And please, if you have any questions or comments, criticisms, brickbats, sort of send them over.
Mr. Sachs?
Yes.
Up here.
Where? Okay. Yeah. One can't tell the direction of sound. Okay, go on.
In reading Awakenings, you see a pattern that comes with people that while they're either when they're having encephalitis or after they've had the L-DOPA, certain things can lead them so that they lose their symptoms for a while. For example, with Rolando P., the singing or the music, he could. And then with Hester, with writing after the L-DOPA. I just want to know if you know why this happened. Or anything about it, because I'm curious.
I should have said more about this. In a way, the Parkinsonian suffers from nothingness and from unrelatedness. You can see this at many levels. For example, a Parkinsonian may be stuck and unable to move, and sort of in a position like this. And in a way, all you need to do then is say, look over there. And in that moment that his regard is taken over there to an object outside him or to the world, he is released from this Parkinsonian spell. He's released from this empty, meaningless space. In the moment that the Parkinsonian is related to something outside his Parkinsonism, whether it's a ball or music or another person or an autobiography or making a shoe, in that moment he ceases to be Parkinsonian. In particular, music, I think, has a very powerful action in Parkinsonism and in many neurological things. I had one patient who was a music teacher who, when she became Parkinsonian, said she had become unmusicked. She felt that her gait had become robotic and wooden and mechanical. And she had to hear music or imagine music to be able to walk properly. There's some Parkinsonians who can't walk but who can dance. In this film, if one could see the whole film, there is one patient who is almost unable to talk but who can sing beautifully. And when she sings, it's full of feeling. I sort of want to make a word play, but I think it's an important one. The opposite of art is inert. In the 17th century, it used to be in art. The Parkinsonian is inert. He has been reduced to some extent to a mechanical inertia and almost a sort of Newtonian inertia. So there is movement which doesn't stop and resistance. And somehow the cure to this inertia, or a cure, is art. And there are Parkinsonians who can hardly write, but who can paint a picture. But basically, one has got to be drawn into relatedness and into action and into art. I think this is true for all of us, but it's spectacularly true for the Parkinsonian who may be completely incapacitated. There's an aphorism which Auden used to like to quote of Novalis, when Novalis says, every disease is a musical problem and every cure is a musical solution. But in Parkinsonism, I think this is almost literally the case. I don't know whether this is an answer. It may simply expand your question. But I think art and action is absolutely fundamental as the great organizer of nervous activity.
Hello. I have a commentary and a question. The commentary is that I had a patient. As a medical student, I had a patient who reminded me of your own malady. This patient had what they call phantom limb, and perhaps it would be of interest to the audience. It was a patient who was a Texas oil worker who had his shoulder traumatically amputated at an oil rig, and later it was unattachable. Later, he complained of itching and burning in his fingertips, and as time went on, he could say where the tip of his fingers were in relation to the shoulder. Of course, his fingers weren't there, but the shoulder, the limb. Shrunk, kind of telescoped in. Eventually he had five little fingers sticking out from his chest, and eventually it went away. And when you made your statement that the mind cannot will itself to recognize a limb which is not that, which is numb, it's not a sense of numbness, it's an absence, nor can the mind make a limb go away, perhaps, you know. And the other question, the question I wanted to ask was one of how close it seems between the fine line between psychological ailment and neurological ailment. You gave the example of the catatonic schizophrenic and the patient with von Economo's encephalitis, or at least in the film. And I wondered about your lady with eyes right. How much of that was denial of her malady rather than simply inability to a true neurological deficit? I guess it becomes something of a moot point because as your example of the sailor, when you presented his problem to him, it caused such anxiety, perhaps. In situations like that, you don't. After a stroke, if they have their own denial mechanisms which allow them to continue in the world, you don't necessarily want to poke at it.
All these neurological conditions I'm describing have psychic concomitants. And the the question as to whether they could be purely psychic, there used to be a particular psychiatric diagnosis for sometimes there are patients who not only maintain that their left half is missing, but who may maintain that their left half belongs to someone else, or who may make very strange... I had one patient who seemed fine when breakfast was brought in, but then when the nurse came to take the tray out, she said, "Oh, and that arm on the tray, take it away, you're too." And a special psychiatric diagnosis was coined at one time for these odd somatic delusions, and it was called somatophrenia fantastica. However, these somatic delusions, or everyone who had this in a gross state, turned out to have large lesions in the sensory parts of the brain in the right hemisphere. And again, the business of not seeing the left half has sometimes been regarded as a denial in the psychiatric sense. But there's rather good physiological evidence for the cerebral disconnection which prevents the person perceiving one side and also prevents them perceiving the imperception. Again, for myself, with the amnesic sailor, I first thought he was hysterical, and then it was gradually brought home to me that he was not. But I agree, one is sort of in strange territory here, and it is easier to talk in terms of denial, which we all do, than in terms of an imperception, which is sort of strange. But I think these matters are deeper than psychiatric syndromes, and I'll just leave it at that. Do I have a notion of what mind is? Or do you have a notion?
Well, I think you've certainly touched on it, Paul Eaton, but I wonder if there's any way of just encompassing the concept.
I don't know that I'm up to it at the moment, but I don't have any feeling of dualism, of the ghost in the machine. I have a sense of mind and brain, or at least mind and body, as being integral and inseparable. I wish I could say in a sentence what people have argued about for 3,000 years, but I don't think I can. There is a sort of materialism which I go along with, but it is really Spinoza's materialism, in which essentially Spinoza says the body is inconceivably complex and wonderful, and the more we realize this, the more we will see that one doesn't need to have anything other than the body. I mean, I certainly regard, in some sense, mind as a function of body, although obviously it's equally a function of interaction of all sorts. But I don't believe in anything, in the possibility of anything disembodied.
I have a question about the L-DOPA in the patients with the post-encephalitis Parkinson's. In people who have Parkinson's, eventually, for some of them, the L-DOPA never doesn't work anymore, and they become rigid and nothing works. With the people with the encephalitis, did that eventually happen?
No, not always. ordinary Parkinson's disease tends to be slowly progressive. Some of these post-encephalitic syndromes, although they were terribly severe, were static. And sometimes if the patient could reach some sort of accommodation, they might hold it 20 years later. So I have patients now who have had 20 years of reasonable life. I mean, there are problems, but at least they are alive and active, and they had no possibility of that before L-DOPA.
That was Oliver Sacks speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1988. Sacks is an accomplished neurologist and best-selling author whose scientific and literary pursuits often overlap. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time to find your story here.